Good morning, everyone. It is September 23rd, 2021. This is the Daily Homeroom, the ADK Homeroom Adirondacks Homeroom. I am your teacher in exile, your host, Frank. And we have a beautiful weekend coming up here in the Adirondacks. I'm going to get out there in my tent. I'm going to go out there with my family. We're going to canoe. We're going to fish. We're going to hike. Why don't you come on up here? It is beautiful. Wherever you are, I hope you get out and you manage to enjoy the weekend too. Still going to have a podcast tomorrow, of course. Don't get me wrong. We will still put this up here tomorrow, Friday morning. But for today, we have a really good topic here. Our topic in this file is, how should we recalibrate our risk assessments given this pandemic? Well, what does that mean? That means that I really think we should reconsider what is most threatening, what is most risky, what imperils human life, human endeavor, and the pursuit of human happiness the most. Because prior to the pandemic, I think it is safe to say, without a doubt, most people would say, oh, the number one problem facing humanity is climate change, right? That was number one with a bullet, with like 20 bullets. We're talking bullets with butterfly wings here. That was everybody, you asked them, what's the biggest problem? Climate change. Oh, in terms of threat to humanity as a species, I'm not talking about day-to-day life right now, but threat to humanity as a species, threat to our life as our way of life as we know it, certainly among the students that I teach, absolutely climate change is number one before the pandemic, and it probably still is now, but that's why I'm doing this topic. Maybe we should recalibrate things a little bit here. Absolutely, climate change would be considered the number one issue in terms of its magnitude, in terms of how it's going to change human life. But let's look at this a little bit more closely, because most people, right, you can look at William Nordhaus's DICE model. He won the Nobel Prize in 2018 for integrating economics and climate change in his DICE model. Or you could look at, there's a new study out from Princeton that's really fascinating, up at MBER, and there are other studies too, and they're all, you know, roughly in the same ballpark. And they're estimating that by the year 2200 now, it used to be 2100 that we did all our global climate change estimates for. Now, in this new paper from Princeton, it's 2200. Nordhaus, of course, still was talking about 2100. So they estimate that by 2200, 2100, somewhere 100 to 200 years in the future, about 10% of the global welfare will be impacted or really taken away by climate change. So in other words, we'll only be at 90% of where we would be without climate change in terms of gross domestic product for all the nations across the globe. 10% of welfare, that is. The Princeton study, actually, if you strictly limit it to GDP, the Princeton study is a little bit more like 5 to 8% somewhere in there by 2200. But including all welfare, GDP, amenities, things like that, more like 10% by 2200 from the Princeton study, and somewhere in that ballpark for our Nobel laureate, Mr. Nordhaus, by 2100 or shortly thereafter, about 100 years in the future from now. So obviously that's bad, right? 10% of welfare lost due to climate change. That is a huge effect. You can easily look at things that are 1% or fractions of 1% of global welfare, and you can say those are important. So to be up at 10%, that is a huge, monstrous number. And that is something that absolutely is concerning. It is right to be concerned about that. But Here's the thing. The pandemic, this COVID pandemic caused by the SARS-CoV-2 virus, this is already at 10% of global welfare. It is squarely in that ballpark right now. Right now, in 2021, we're already there. Some estimates are more than 10%, some are less. But the point is that right now, with the pandemic, we are in that ballpark. And climate change, which was everybody's number one with a bullet, is talking about 10% change by the year 2100 or 2200 even. So that should give us pause, right? When we compare 10% now to 10% in 2100, 2200, clearly, you know, the present day value of that 2200 money is much less, right? Right now, because you've got growth and you've got interest to account for. So we're talking actually potentially much greater costs from the pandemic right now. And between now and 2100, between now and 2200, there are likely to be many, many more such incidents, many more incidents like the pandemic, right? We seem to be having some sort of event of this magnitude maybe every 20, 25 years. You had World War II, you had then about, 20 years until the start of Vietnam. Then from the end of Vietnam till 9/11, you had maybe 25 years. From 9/11 until now, you have 20 years. So not all of these things are exactly equal in magnitude, but these sort of big geopolitical crises that have the potential to impact global welfare and global GDP seem to be coming up every 20 years or so. So it would be, I think, naive and myopic not to understand that by 2100 and 2200, we are going to be having more events like this pandemic, more events like a war. Let's hope not. Let's hope that the better angels of our nature, as Professor Pinker would say, win out. And I think there is a lot to be said for the fact that the generals and the rulers understand that now with nuclear bombs, they have a very good chance of dying themselves, right? And so this puts them off the whole big, giant, full-out war idea, which is great. I think that personal threat, them saying, ooh, maybe I could get taken out in this nuclear bomb, I think that has made, in some sense, paradoxically perhaps, the advent of nuclear weapons a stabilizing force on the global geopolitical scene. However, it would be naive, as I say, not to expect more events that have the potential to impact global GDP at least the 10% level. And so, as a result of that, when we compare what we're doing, when we compare risks, I'm not sure that climate change should really be number one with a bullet. In fact, I don't think it should be. I think that we have other things, as this pandemic has demonstrated, that have just as large a chance, or perhaps larger chance, of having just as big a magnitude, or perhaps even larger magnitude, and we should be focusing on them. I'll get to what they are in a second, but first, let me give you a little simple heuristic for thinking about risk. Now, this is a heuristic. This is a simple rule. This is a simple algorithm, maybe we should say. There's no sophistication to this. But back of the envelope type of calculation can be very useful. So here it is. When you're thinking about risk, simply consider the two pieces, the chances of it happening and the magnitude of the effects if it were to happen. So that first piece, the chances of it happening, right? That's like cross-section of physics if you're doing a lot of particle physics. And why not? Maybe you are. Then that could be considered the cross-section, the chances of the event actually occurring. And then the magnitude of the effects were it to occur. That's the second piece. So let's think about this. The cross section of me eating a cheeseburger for dinner, the chance of that happening, man, yeah, that's pretty good. That's pretty high chances. But the magnitude of the effects of me having a cheeseburger for dinner today, nobody cares. Nobody cares. That's a small thing. So you multiply those two together, large cross section, large chance of happening, multiply that by a infinitesimally small, a negligibly small effect, and you get a big meh. Who cares? Small effect, nobody cares. But maybe let's consider I eat nothing but cheeseburgers for every meal constantly, and I eat 30 of them a day. It's a lot of cheeseburgers. Well, let's consider that risk. First of all, the cross section, the chances of it happening is pretty small. I'm not going to do that. There's no way I would do that. However, the magnitude of the effects would be pretty big, right? If I did do that, I'd be beyond supersize me, cholesterol, blood pressure, horrific results, heart disease. So the magnitude would be big. But multiply that by the chances of it happening, and again, you get a meh. So to think about risk, there's your simple rule, your simple algorithm. Just multiply the chance of it happening by the magnitude of effect. You have a small chance, but a really huge effect that can be significant. You might find something, and I think we will here in about 2 seconds, that has a small chance of happening, but the effects of it are so enormous. Remember, enormous implies big in a bad way. It's not really a neutral word, enormous. So the small chances, but big effects, they can multiply into something you should worry about. But if you have small chances, small magnitude, not so much. Big chances, big effect. Obviously, you should worry about that when you multiply them together. So let's see. What sort of risks are out there that we might need to recalibrate for besides climate change? Well, allow me to introduce yourself, to introduce you. And some of you will have known him already. That's great if you do. To Nathan Myhrvold. Nathan is one heck of an interesting guy. One reason he's interesting is if you look up Nathan Myhrvold on Amazon, you will see that he is very successful selling books about bread for $625. That is a really expensive book about bread. Why is Nathan selling a book about bread for $625 on Amazon? The short answer is kind of because he can. Why can he do that? A, they're really cool books. If you can imagine like a book about cooking bread with Star Trek engineering for the cooking and Ansel Adams quality pictures, but in color, amazing pictures, then that's the type of book that you're talking about here. And it's 5 volumes, right? This thing is longer than a school awards ceremony in June in 90 degree weather outdoors. They are long books. So that's one reason that he can do it. The other reason he can sell bread books for $625 on Amazon is he's already a gazillionaire. He is a billionaire from being the chief technical officer of Microsoft way back in the early days. Very intelligent guy, very clever guy, very interesting guy. So the point is not simply that he sells these great bread books and other, he has, it's called Modernist Cuisine. He has other cooking books out there too, similarly expensive, similarly great. But Nathan also has for 99 cents, for 99 cents only up on Amazon, tells you something about our relative value of these topics. For 99 cents on Amazon, Nathan has a pamphlet, honest to goodness Thomas Paine pamphlet called Strategic Terrorism, A Call to Action. And he published this about 10 years ago, this pamphlet. I used to be able to get it for free at Lawfare, but I don't think you can anymore. But hey, pony up the 99 cents on Amazon. It's worth it. I would recommend it even more than I recommend spending $625 on a book about bread. So in this book, pamphlet, excuse me, Strategic Terrorism, A Call to Action, Nathan says, the most frightening of all technological possibilities is the development of biological agents, both natural and engineered plagues. Ahem, he published this about 10 years ago. At the time, I said, he's right. Of course he's right. At the time. Nathan also says we should not, as a nation, with our national security apparatus, be focused on preventing tactical terrorism, little tiny tactics, little skirmishes, little tiny engagements, bombings. These might kill a lot of people, but they don't really threaten humanity as a whole. They are not going to change the course of history. They are not going to divert the course of nations from what it otherwise would have been. On the other hand, Nathan contrasts that to strategic terrorism, which would be the type of terrorism coming from an individual, a rogue agent perhaps, not excluding state actors, but then we probably would call it terrorism for etymological and historical reasons, I guess, even though it might amount to being the same thing. But Nathan contrasts that tactical terrorism, the little tiny terrorist acts, bombings. And when I say little tiny, yes, it's terribly sad, it's tragic. You're killing, 3,000 people, 6,000 people. This would be very, very sad, very, very scary. But he contrasts that with strategic terrorism, which would change the course of history, which would divert the path of nation states from what they were on before. Take out half of all humanity, perhaps, with an engineered plague, or even all of humanity with an engineered biological plague. As Nathan Myhrvold points out here, quote, for the first time in human history, the curve of cost versus lethality has turned rapidly downward. That's a complicated way to say that nowadays a single person, a single actor can be extremely lethal, like changing the course of history lethal, like strategically lethal for very, very cheap. And it's true. He's right. It was true 10 years ago when he wrote it. And I think now that we are in this post-pandemic world, or maybe not quite post-pandemic yet, sigh, tear, now that we are in this pandemic world, it is even more of a threat. So let's put this into the simple algorithm that I was talking about a moment ago. For an engineered plague, for strategic terrorism, for a single actor or small group of people like maybe the Aum Shinrō cult in Tokyo, if they were active today, these were the people that I believe released sarin gas, it was, in the Tokyo subway a couple decades ago. So what is the cross section? What is the chance that a small group or an individual is able to develop an engineered plague that could take out all of humanity, or a significant portion, or at least change the course of history? Well, I think the chances are depressingly large. I don't think that they are maybe above 5%. I don't think they're above 5%, but when we're talking about comparing the odds of this to the odds of climate change wiping out the Earth or something else, I think they're in the same ballpark. I really do. I think that as an existential threat, a small actor, an act of strategic terrorism using biological agents is up there, high, relatively high on the scale of probabilities. Certainly it's up there with the probability of climate change destroying humanity, destroying all life, right? Maybe the carbon dioxide gets released from the permafrost and chokes, half the planet to death. That is a far-fetched but not impossible result of climate change. And this terrorism, this biological engineered plague that Myhrvold and I are talking about here, yes, it might be a small chance in absolute terms, but compared to these other risks, I think that it's on the same order as these other risks. And my point with this podcast is that everybody had been saying that climate change is huge and is the number one with the bullet, and that's far and away our biggest concern, And I'm trying to pull Lee Corso and say, not so fast, my friend. Other things are up there. So if you multiply the chances of it happening by the magnitude of the effect for an engineered plague, I think that it is extremely concerning. And to me, it is even more concerning than climate change. Just to go through a couple other of these real fast, artificial intelligence, again, I would say small chances, small cross section of evil AI taking out the world, but the magnitude of effect, yeah, that's huge. So that is a concern. Multiplying small chances, but a huge magnitude of effect, that is a very big concern. In fact, I would put that overall, the product of those two things, the result of our algorithm, I would put that over climate change also. Natural disease, I would put over that, especially as we go stirring up bat caves, right? A combination war, an NBCE war, nuclear, biological, chemical, electromagnetic war, I would say, again, bigger than climate change risk, right? If you multiply the chances of it happening by the magnitude of effect, if it does happen, I would put that above climate change. Just a nuclear war, maybe the chances are slightly higher, but they're about the same. And I would actually say that the magnitude of effect from just a nuclear war is slightly lower. It is slightly lower than the worst case of AI or the worst case of a bioengineered plague or a natural plague. So the short answer to all of this recalibration of our risks, the question, should we be recalibrating our risk? The short answer is yes. And nobody's talking about it. I think the pandemic is evidence. It is a strong indication that we need to recalibrate our risks. And yes, climate change is a concern, but when you consider the simple algorithm, chance of happening multiplied by the magnitude of effect, I think that you will see that climate change does not crack the top five. Does not crack the top five giant risks. So, something to think about as we head into the weekend. Now, we need a quiz here. We haven't done one of these quizzes for a while, and I love them so much. So, we talked about bread today. Let's do an E. Paul Torrens creativity quiz. We'll do it in the fluency category on bread. So, how many different types of bread? How many different uses for the word bread can you think of? I will give you the clue. You give me the answer. Number one, we have five questions here. Number one, farting bastard or farting goblin. Yes, that is pumpernickel. Pumpernickel means farting goblin. That's the type of bread it is. Number two, Aubrey was her name. Or baby, I'ma want you. Yes, that's from the band Bread. Led by David Gates. Another use of the word bread there. Number three, Juliet's birthday. Yes, Juliet Capulet. Juliet's birthday was Lammas Eve. And of course, Lammas is like loaf. It is the festival of the wheat harvest, the festival when you get the wheat to make your bread. Number four, Peter Bruegel the Elder. That might be a tough one. All right, yes, it is his painting, The Cripples, because in that painting, The Cripples, ergotism has crippled everybody. And of course, ergotism is when you get those fungus, those bad pieces of wheat in your bread supply, fungal infection there. Also, notice that ergotism drove some Renaissance painters a little bit crazy, like maybe Bosch, because ergots can act as a hallucinogen. Number five, five barley loaves and two fish. Yes, that example of bread is the feeding of the 5,000, the miracle of the feeding of 5,000, which is the only miracle reported in all four gospels of the New Testament of the Christian Bible. Of course, what could that mean? What could that mean that it was the only miracle reported in all four of the Gospels? Something to think about, something to ponder. All right, folks, go out, enjoy, have a super day. I will see you tomorrow. Take care.